This episode is brought to you by the Arvada Center, because they're kicking off their summer concert series in June. Relax under the stars at the Arvada Center's outdoor amphitheater and take in acts like Melissa Etheridge, Big Richard, Tower of Power, Preservation Hall Jazz Band, The Spin Doctors, and so much more. Concerts are scheduled for June through September. You can find a whole schedule of events and get your tickets today at arvadacenter.org. That's arvadacenter.org. Today on CityCast Denver, Mayor Mike Johnston marks his 100th day in office today. So me and producer Paul Caroli sat down with him at the City and County Building downtown to talk about the real reason Johnston canceled plans for that micro community in the Golden Triangle and what he says to the critics on council complaining about a lack of transparency. Today is Wednesday, October 25th. I'm Bree Davies, and here's what Denver's talking about.
I was just saying that I feel slightly embarrassed hosting you in the office, which feels like your freshman dorm room that has no decorations in it. So if someone's got like a Water Lilies poster hanging around or an old Reservoir Dogs poster or something, we could use it.
Oh,
yeah. Because right now it's pretty much just empty.
Did you have a musician poster in your dorm room?
What did I have in my dorm room?
Great question. Great question.
I had a super artistic guy who was one of my roommates who actually hand drew on our wall is it the Da Vinci painting of sort of God giving life to man?
I think it's the
Da Vinci or Michelangelo maybe. So he hand drew that on our wall. And I was like, okay, I don't have that skill, but I will be happy to put my...
That's a way better than like a poster of Bob Marley or something,
exactly.
Which is like no diss. I love Bob Marley, but it's more run of the mill.
I just left my heavy, smelly bag of hockey gear instead in the common room. That was my contribution.
You're a hockey player?
I was a hockey player and a soccer player.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Me too. I played hockey like my whole life.
Really?
Yeah.
I was a goalie, which accounts for
interesting.
Some things.
Yeah.
A lot of shots to the head.
Goalies. I mean, okay. That explains some things to me. I like that. What do you say we get started?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Sounds great.
Mayor Mike Johnston, welcome back to CityCast Denver.
Thank you. So delighted to be back with you.
Let's talk about the biggest news of the week, I think, which is your escalating disagreement with City Council over the budget for rental assistance next year. They asked for an additional $17.5 million from what you put in your budget. And they're talking about, you know, helping people keep from getting evicted. You agreed to only $3 million more. What is the core disagreement here? Because it seems like this really is the thing.
Yeah, I actually don't see it as a disagreement at all. I think we both totally agree with this priority. I'd start with obviously the importance of, you all know this, we want to keep people from entering homelessness in the first place. And it is not just the right humanitarian thing to do, it's the right financial thing to do. Often if someone is at risk of being evicted and they get evicted, we can spend $2,000 or $3,000, $5,000 to help them stay in their unit and be able to pay rent. Or if we don't and they become homeless, we pay $30,000 or $40,000 to support them. So it's just good math for the city. We agree with that. That's actually why, sort of hidden in the budget story, is we already proposed a 500% expansion of rental assistance in our budget. So we are all in on that. What the council's worried about, which we understand, is last year the city did about $3 million. We did $15 million this year, which is a big number. But last year we had about $15 million from state and federal sources that disappeared this year. And so what it looked like was there was the total number is smaller. Our city contribution is 500% higher. So I am all in believing that it matters. We want to do as much of it as we can. We just have the solemn obligation to deliver a balanced budget. And so we got to manage it against a bunch of other priorities, like making sure we can build more affordable housing and making sure we can be able to get people's, not have to have them pay more for trash, and making sure we can get enough sheriffs to fill our jail so we don't have people that aren't safe or being well cared for. And so we're just trying to be mindful about all the other things that matter. But I share this as a huge priority for the city and agree with the council on that.
But it does seem like there is a disagreement because they want more money. Then
oh,
it seems like you're willing to give.
They definitely want more money, and I understand that. There's a lot of things. I have a list of 50 things I'd love to spend more money on at the city. Unfortunately, we're not the federal government where you can print money. You have to deliver a balanced budget, and so they would like to do more. That would require us to dip into the city reserves to do that. I'm not sure what they'll propose, how it's funded, so I will have to hear what they describe. But right now, to dip into reserves would be, you know, it risks the city's bond rating. It risks us not having those reserves we need if we do have another 3,000 people a night that are coming that are refugees. Refugee seekers from Venezuela. We know there are just contingency things that cities have to meet that we want to make sure to be ready for. And so we're just trying to balance our shared commitment to rental assistance with our shared commitment to make sure we have a balanced budget and we have a city that can withstand whatever crises might come.
So speaking of the budget and city council, Councilwoman Stacey Gilmore made this video and she accused you of not being transparent with which specific projects are getting funding in the 2024 budget. Do you have a response to Councilwoman Gilmore?
Yeah, I understand her question. The issue was about, well, the way the budget process works is, you know, all of the agencies all work for me. I'm the CEO, where they are all executive agencies. So they each prepare their own budget of what they'd like to do. And they bring that to us from 25 different agencies. As you can imagine, each department also has their own long list of things they want to do. And then we have to take all those requests and make all 25 of those budget proposals meet. And so, you know, those individual agencies would have proposed together, you know, $300-400 million more than we have in the budget. So we have to then decide which of these can we fix, which can we do, which can we not do. That's an internal conversation our team has with the cabinet leaders to figure out how we prioritize that budget. And then we all go forward on it together. And so what she wanted was, what were the things people submitted that we ended up deciding not to fund? Kind of what is everyone's individual wish list? So we're entirely transparent about everything in the budget that we fund. But for us, that part of making the budget is what we do as an internal team to look at all of our priorities. And we have to make hard decisions that every department's got 25 priorities and we can't meet all 25 of them. And the budget, the leaders of each department know that entirely, which is why there's never been a practice in the city's history for them to release early budget negotiations to the public.
So this is not something that maybe a previous mayor would have done?
This is something that every mayor has done all throughout history, has never released the internal first draft negotiations of what departments ask for. Because they come to us with all the things they'd love to do, which is what we ask them to do, be big and visionary. And we got to figure out how that matches with the other 24 departments who also have big and visionary ideas with a limited budget. So it's just a part of the budget process that every mayor has done before us. We've done consistently. The city attorney has made it clear that it's protected work documents. So there's never been a process to do this before, and we don't see a reason to change it.
Hmm. All right, well, let's move on then to, I think, the biggest issue in the city. It's clearly been your biggest priority in your first 100 days, which is homelessness, our unhoused crisis. I want to start with something that you did that I thought was very cool, which was, do you remember the first sweep you ordered at 22nd and Curtis? It was maybe like 2 weeks after your inauguration. You went down a couple of nights before to the camp and you were talking to people, and I read that you exchanged phone numbers with some folks who are living there. Have you kept in touch with those people?
I have kept in touch with people at a number of different encampments that we go to visit, because I think they're constituents and residents who have concerns and questions, and I find I learn a lot from them. You know, one of the women that I exchanged phone numbers with at that location was a former city employee. And she'd worked in the Denver City and County just 3 years ago, and then went through some tough life circumstances, and now trying to find her way back together. So it was a great example for me of, you know, every one of these individuals are just one or two steps away from being the person that's working next to you. I find, and sometimes it's services. You know, it might be we got someone who's really trying to get connected to the VA and can't get connections, and I'll give them my number or Chase's number or someone on our team to say, we know we have departments that do great work. Sometimes it helps to just have a direct contact. I try to build those relationships wherever I can.
Well, so with that sweep, that early sweep, what I'm particularly curious about is the offer of housing, because that's something that you came in promising to do very different from your predecessor, was to make sure anytime you ordered a sweep, you'd have housing to offer. And in that first one, you weren't able to do that. You didn't have any housing. So I wonder if you got any of those people who you got their phone numbers, did you get them connected to housing now that some units have become available?
I'm really glad that you asked, because I think there's been some, I get some questions about this sometime, which is, this was exactly our commitment, is what we want to do is actually open units of housing we can move people to when we close encampments. That's why we're trying to bring on these 1,000 units to move the people that need it into those units. We've done our first successful closure of an encampment that we closed and moved all 83 people into housing. That was great. What we do know is, in the interim, you know, those 1,000 units aren't going to be on ready until close to the end of the year. So we have, in the meantime, folks are stuck still living outdoors, which we don't like, but we're trying to support them in every way that we can. In some places, we're bringing bathroom access or trash pickup. But what I've said is, only in places where we have either real public health or public safety risks or right-of-way infringements, or if there's private property involved, do we still have to sometimes move people, which we don't like to do, but we can't avoid it. In that instance, there was a massive rat infestation underneath all those tents that was putting folks at risk. We had another camp that had a couple of repeated shootings. We had one that had an explosion from multiple propane gas tanks. And so we've tried to really limit those movements to when there are those public health or safety risks. But I know what people ask is, it is still possible we will have camp movements or cleanups over the next month or two before we can get everyone to housing, because we may still have public health or safety risks. But the end goal is always to be able to close encampments and move people to housing. all we have to do is make sure we can bring on enough units fast enough to do that. That's why we're running at such breakneck speed, right? I mean, I think previously it took something like 3 years to site the first micro community in Denver, and that was for 40 units. You know, we're trying to do 9 sites in 1,000 units in 90 days, which is kind of historic on all fronts. And we know that city employees are working around the clock to make it happen. And I know for some people, what the great feedback I get is every time I talk to people in encampments now, they say, hey, when's my housing coming? Like, we're ready to go. I'm ready to move. And I love that urgency, and that drives our urgency, but that's why we got to get those units up so we can get people moved into housing.
So Denverite reported that, quote, anyone who was homeless on the streets who secured housing through the city and lives indoors for at least 14 days will have received what Johnston is considering a housing outcome. What is this 14 days? How did you come up with
that? Yeah, and that's my mistake. I'm just not communicating clearly on that. It was funny. We thought we were improving the system because the current HUD outcome was 1 day. So they count someone housed if they're in housing for 1 day. And we were like, that's crazy. This is only our first indicator of 20 indicators, but the very first indicator should be if we don't even have you for 14 consistent days, if you're there for 2 days and gone, we didn't succeed in any way. So that was meant to be a small adjustment to say, let's extend the expectation from 1 to 14 as the very first benchmark. But we have 10 to 20 benchmarks we'll track after that, which are all of the long-term prognosis. So the real goal is you stay in housing or in our transitional housing, which would be these hotel rooms or micro communities or leased units. We then help you if you need workforce training, if you need mental health support, addiction treatment, we're getting you all that. We're getting into a job. You're saving up first month, second month's rent, and then we're moving you into your own permanent unit that you're paying your own rent on. And then we're tracking you to make sure you're employed, you're stayed employed, you're not returning to homelessness. And that's for not just 14 days, that's 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 3 months, 6 months. We'll track folks over the course of all 4 years. So all those outcomes matter. That was meant to just be the very first indicator. And we were actually extending the timeline on that, not shortening it, but I think we didn't communicate it very well.
I want to talk about this like search for land and like building housing. This is such an interesting process to me because it strikes me that what you're doing is you're just buying up property. You're looking for land. Like how is that going? Has it been harder than you thought? Has it been easier? Do landlords know you're coming?
It's funny. It has been, I spend more of my time than I thought as like an amateur real estate broker, you know, trying to find, you know, the same is true for trying to support migrants and newcomers that have arrived. We need to find shelter, non-congregate shelter and congregate shelter for them. So on multiple fronts, we're looking for those units all the time. It's actually been very encouraging that people have been very supportive. I mean, every time I do, we've done maybe 40 or more community meetings now. And at almost every one, someone will come up and say, hey, I have a plot of land I'd be happy to help support. Or, hey, what about this spot down the street that I think could be a good location? What we find is just every location has its own complexity. I mean, we started with a list of almost 2,000 sites and we're down to, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 right now. Hmm. It could be anything from, you know, water to electricity access to whatever the private landowner needs to development rights of way to, you know, proximity to other resources we need like grocery store or transit or whatnot. So, and then also because for the micro community sites, these are meant to be short-term sites. You know, sometimes it's going to be 2 to 4 years as the zoning permit. You want to make sure whatever you're doing on the site is worth it for a short-term investment. You know, you don't want to spend $10 million to retrofit a site for you to have, you know, 30 people there for 4 years. And so we're trying to find the right balance of the properties that are ready to go and that provide access to the resources people need, but are still cost effective for taxpayers.
It sounds like,
yes, I'm always searching. So if anyone's listening that has vacant sites, I want them, please reach out to us.
That's interesting that people are coming forward to offer up their space. I was kind of imagining the opposite, that like your ambitious goals would be putting a time clock on your search. And then that, you know, if I'm a landowner, I know I have more leverage. You know, I know you have these ambitious goals to hit. Maybe I put the screws in you a little bit.
You know, we haven't seen much of that. I do think people will say, we know this is a crisis. We want to help. We want to be part of the solution. And to be clear, we're not at all believing this is some sort of mission accomplished on December 31st, like the challenges of homelessness are over. We know this is just a first step. There's lots more to do. We'll be adding more units and more sites in 2024. Our budget has called for another 1,000 units in 2024. The long-term goal is, of course, you get folks stabilized and then into their own permanent housing. But we know affordable housing is a big crisis for everyone in the city, not just folks that are unhoused. And so we're working on adding 3,000 units a year, every year of permanently affordable housing for all working families and working individuals across the city. But we need to get people off the streets where they're most at risk into this transitional housing so then we can add the long-term supply of permanent housing to move people up and through that pipeline.
The
This episode is brought to you by Pine Melon, the farmer's market delivered. Pine Melon is a next generation grocery delivery app that partners with over 200 farmers, ranchers, and producers in Colorado to help make fresh, locally sourced foods available to the Denver community at fair prices. Get high quality meats, eggs, and dairy from small local farms, fresh baked breads from local bakeries, and more, as well as all of your favorite pantry staples. Best part is, Pine Melon offers same-day delivery to Denver and soon Boulder within a two-hour window, no subscription necessary. Save time in your busy schedule and get fresh and healthy groceries delivered right to your door. Join the movement and support local today. Use promo code CITYCASTDENVER for $75 off your first delivery at pinemelon.com. That's pinemelon.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. We're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
So we're talking about micro communities, and you picked 11 sites across the city, but you've already backed off one in the Golden Triangle after pushback from neighbors and shrank the size of another potential site in Overland Park, or I'm sorry, in Overland. Can you walk me through the decision you made to cancel that Golden Triangle site?
You know, we have many sites that we're working on publicly, and I can tell you, you know, some we haven't released that have been private land negotiations. We just updated the council on that. We've had probably, you know, 10 or 12 sites we've been working directly. We've had to let go because we've had challenges either with landowners or with site development. One of the challenges on the Bannock site was it had a huge sinkhole in the middle of it. And so it was going to require significant time and remediation costs to do that, just to literally flatten out dirt to put micro communities on. And the cost to that site for, you know, and there, that's still a private landowner that wants to eventually have some other use for it. And so the amount of money and time we had to put in to retrofitting for a very short amount of time and use, we thought was going to be challenging. And we did have another great site in the community that was two blocks away. And so, and this was one where when you said to people offer sites, I mean, people came to those community conversations and yeah, they had concerns about that site, but they also said, we want our neighborhood to do its part. We definitely want to have a site in the neighborhood. We're open to another site in District 10 and we'll help you find other sites. They've been suggesting sites to us. We're chasing them down. We really want to have another District 10 site and we will work on that. So I don't view it as all as a move away from. I'd say that wasn't the specific site for a number of reasons. There are other sites we think in District 10 that would work, and Councilman Hines has been very supportive of that. So we're continuing to search.
So it wasn't because many neighbors were vocally directly opposed to it.
I mean, we tried to take both sides of feedback. One was we put all these sites out publicly for conversation for two reasons. One is we got to do all the permitting and siting and cost analysis to see what the risks are there. And then we want to get feedback from community to figure out what their thoughts or risks or concerns are. And this one had challenges on both fronts. We knew we had community feedback, but we also had real structural challenges at the same time. And so we try to see always the ways we can work through whatever the structural challenges are and the community challenges are and get to the best possible agreement on both. And in a lot of sites, we've had real success on that. And some sites we've hit challenges, but mostly those tend to lead with structural challenges.
I have to be honest with you. I struggle because I'm in District 3,
yeah.
Jamie Torres's district. We've already had two safe yeah. outdoor spaces that by all accounts went really well. One was a couple blocks from my house. It's now being, now that it's done, it's lease is up. It's becoming affordable housing for seniors. But my concern is my neighborhood, the average income is much lower than say the Golden Triangle. Is this going to become one of those things where lower income communities like mine end up shouldering the responsibility of more affordable housing or more micro communities when say a Bell Caro or Wash Park or Bonnie Bray doesn't have to because their neighbors say, we don't want it?
No, I'm really glad that you raised that because that is not what's happening and that's not our design. In fact, actually, we don't have any sites in District 3 right now.
Here's which I would say we would welcome too. I don't want to say we're not welcome to them, but
totally
we've just
agree.
Already been there. You
but
know?
We've been monitoring that. The thing that we're most excited about is the 11 sites we put forward publicly. 10 of those 11 sites are all in neighborhoods and zip codes with higher than the average median income in the city and county of Denver. So we wanted not to make sure they were in places that already had families that were struggling. That's been a key part of the priority, and that we still have sites moving in all 11 council districts. So we're working on sites in all those places. What we just find out is you never know. We had two sites in District 3 we were quite excited about that both didn't work out in this round for various issues with landowners and others. We're going to go back and keep going. Council President supportive of that. So we think it is going to be a process to find those sites. But what I've been very encouraged by is most every council district has had your response. They've said, we do think it's a citywide problem. We do think all districts should have sites, and we're willing to be part of it. Here are the questions I have. We have some sites in District 4 where there were people that were concerned around one site, but they offered two other sites, and we're actually looking at those two sites. They may come through. So I think they were good for their word. They didn't just say, don't bring it at all to my council district. They just said, there are some things I don't like about this site that are problematic, but we would love to help you find other sites. I think that's been most of the spirit people have brought. And I think in part because they're seeing it work, when they see that we can move people out of encampments into housing, that works for the individuals. It works for us to close down encampments and keep neighborhoods free of that. I think people are excited about the project actually working, and they realize this is the key to it working.
We got to drill down a little deeper on this angry, loud neighbors issue, because this is something we've seen be repeated over and over and over. And it's not just on your House 1000 project, on bike lanes too. I mean, there's always these people, the people who can show up to the meetings and express themselves. You just said a few minutes ago, those are voices you want to listen to. But how do you think about that issue of the loudest voices in the room, the people that are able to show up at the end of a day where someone else maybe had, worked
had to
too
work
long.
I'm very mindful of that, because I've done about 40 of these community meetings, and you do see who can show up and who can make it and what neighborhoods they can make it in and what capacity they have. What I've tried to be focused on is I try to make sure we balance voices that aren't in the room. So things like, for instance, deliberately having conversations with unhoused neighbors, which we do regularly, going to encampments and getting that feedback. So it's not just folks that might have concerns. It's also talking to faith leaders. It's talking to nonprofits. It's talking to providers that are doing work in the communities. So we're trying to balance that outcome. And then I always say I'm open to take feedback. I don't mind people yelling at me. I was a school principal for a long time, so I'm used to that. But I think we have to stay focused on what is the vision we're trying to accomplish and how do we get from here to there. And if someone doesn't fundamentally agree with the vision, if you believe, these folks don't deserve help and shouldn't get resources and they should just either be arrested or held accountable or pushed along, we're not going to agree on the vision on that. I'm happy to hear you out and why you believe that. If you understand that vision, but you have concerns about how we're going to get from here to there, then I'm happy to listen to you and see if there's a way we can find common ground. I think what I most often hear is people who have fear, because what they are associating this strategy with is what they see as the current experience of homelessness in Denver, which is if you go by an encampment and you see folks that are living out there without, any storage or stuff, and your stuff's all over the street and there's no bathroom you have access to, so there's feces or urine on the road and you can't get trash pickup, so you got trash all over the place. I visited an encampment where I was talking to folks and he said, I don't know what to do with this, Mike. And I look out and someone had just dropped food at his tent, and they had dropped, 15 pounds of ground beef. Doesn't have a stove to cook that on, and it's gathering rats and flies, and that looks like it's his problem, and it's not. So I think it is our ability to say, if we want to be able to find ways to support with those wraparound services, we will. And we want to get people to housing, we will. If you have feedback about how to make it better, I'm very open to listen, but I'm not willing to just give up on the idea because you're upset. And I think we just have to get people to be able to see what can be as opposed to what is. And so that's why we keep pushing through. And I know you're worried this is going to be the worst version. We know it can be the best version. We just got to get there.
I feel like that's a great segue to our next question here from a listener. Bree, do you want to give
sure.
it to us?
Yeah. Our listener says, hi, CityCast. It seems like a lot of Mayor Johnston's work has been focused on homelessness, but obviously other issues are still pressing. Could you ask specifically about his plans to increase our sustainability and climate resiliency, especially how he plans to promote the reliability of RTD?
Woohoo! So excited. And I think, thank you, listener. I think but both are true. This is a really important first step for us that we're focused a lot of time and effort on. And we are also focused on a whole number of other city priorities that maybe aren't getting as much coverage right now, because this is a kind of high profile scoreboard to watch of what's happening here, particularly on climate. I mean, some of the things we haven't discussed in the budget that we have real agreement on is we are going to really push aggressively on climate goals, particularly on trying to convert gas vehicles to electric. That includes both for our own city fleet, we're pushing to convert far more of our fleet to be all electric, and on creating infrastructure for charging stations all across the city. So it makes it easier for all of us to be able to stop using vehicles that are gas burning, and also focusing on increasing public transit and access to transit. So one of the things we did to try to increase the reliability and the safety of RTD is we want our own staff to be using it also. So we did all 13,000 city employees, we provided free eco passes to, so they can use RTD or light rail to get to and from work. And we're working on partnering now with businesses all around the downtown area to do the same, to be able to help them partner with us. They can even use our reduced rate if they want to buy in that way, so that they can make it easier. If you're a server working downtown, you don't have to pay $20 to park down here or pay for expensive access. We wanted to make it easier for you to get to and from work and for people to get to and from downtown to enjoy that activity. So that's both good for climate and good for transit. So we are focused also on residential and commercial conversion from to all electric utilities, which is going to be an important part of electrifying the city to make sure we have less oil and gas usage there. So we're really focused on Denver being a national, international leader in the climate space. And so we will be pushing hard on many of those. But some of the first ones are about both public transit, are about the electrification of buildings, and about our electrification of our fleet and the city fleet.
Okay, one last thing. I lurk on you on social media. I saw you kicking it with Travis Scott at Ball Arena. Well, I was going to ask you if you're like a Utopia era Travis Scott guy or an Astroworld era Travis Scott guy, but I really just want to know if you're really enjoying being the mayor. It seems like a sweet perk.
I do love being the mayor. I have to say, and I confess this to Travis Scott, my son is a massive Travis Scott fan.
I figured. I didn't want to assume.
Yes, I am not as knowledgeable about Travis. I did listen to a whole bunch of his stuff after that. So I did most of the Utopia. I had to listen to it without my daughter in the room, it turns out, because it is not all PG. It was wonderful to get to bump into him, and it totally, I think it was the first time my son was like, maybe it's worth you being mayor. We were just on the way to the Broncos game, by the way, and ran into him there. And so great to be Travis Scott, right? Because you have a concert at 7 p.m. You're like,
oh, that's why he was back. You guys were at, okay. He
I
was
did not
at
get Empower, to go to the show. He was at Empower Field for the Broncos game.
Because he was posing with their trophies.
Yeah.
Now
so
I get
he was
it.
Like, I'll just catch the Broncos game, you know, from the field before I go and do my own show. Now, I was embarrassingly the idiot who said, oh my gosh, so nice to meet you. What brings you to town? Which my son kicked me and was like, maybe the sold out show at Ball Arena tonight. So not my best performance.
Whoops.
Yeah, not my best performance, but I will work on doing better next time.
Well, Mayor, thank you so much. This was lovely.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I was coming and talking to Jordan, it's like what I love about getting to be with you all is there are a few times where we have the chance to answer with depth and nuance some of the challenges that we're facing and the city's facing. And when you get one snippet in a press release, it's very hard to sometimes talk about questions like budget balancing or site process or approval process for different sites in depth. And so I both super grateful for what you all add to the civic engagement and news infrastructure of the city, and delighted to join you all.
Thanks.
Well, appreciate you saying that.
You bet.
Thanks for your time.
Have a great day.
That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. If you enjoyed this show, why not take a minute to tell your favorite Voodoo Donuts employee about us? Rate the show wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to our morning newsletter, Hey Denver, and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. We'll be back tomorrow morning with more news from around the city. See you later. And other pressing issues facing the city, like donuts. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba. Woo! I met one of those guys, those old radio guys. It was the wildest thing. He had a soundboard that had all those like, his name was Rick.